When you fall headlong into a fantasy and break your marriage vows and sleep with another man, you never ever think that your fingerprints will end up in a murder investigation. She wants to protect Robert, so she hasn't told the detectives everything. She hasn't told them that Robert told her that night that he suspected Amanda was having an affair. She's afraid if the police know, they will think he has a motive. And she hadn't told Robert, when she was lying in bed with him, that she knew who Amanda might be having an affair with. She won't tell the detectives what she saw, not unless it becomes absolutely necessary, because she knows who Amanda's lover is, and there's no way he killed her either.
Chapter 12. When Detective Webb looks at Robert Pierce that afternoon, he sees a man who might be perfectly capable of killing his wife. Pierce is very good-looking, clever, a little egotistical, a bit prickly. He must have been quite different with his neighbor, Becky Harris, Webb thinks. We all wear masks. We all have something to hide at one point or another. He wants to know what Robert Pierce might be hiding. Pierce is in the chair across the interview table in complete control of himself. He sits comfortably, leaning back in the chair, but his eyes are sharp, missing nothing. "So, I'm the obvious suspect, is that it?" Pierce says. "You're not a suspect at this time," Webb replies, "and you're not in custody. You're free to go if you like." Pierce stays put. Webb studies him carefully and begins. "You say you arrived home right after work about 5 o'clock Friday the 29th. Anybody see you?" "I don't know. That's your job, isn't it? Isn't that what you've been asking the neighbors?" Unfortunately for the detectives, the door-to-door had been frustrating. With the exception of Becky Harris, no one seemed to know the Pierces. They kept to themselves. No one remembered seeing Robert Pierce coming or going from his house that weekend. He had a habit of keeping his car in the garage with the doors closed, so it was hard to say if he was home. Except for Jeanette Barath, no one had noticed anyone else going in or out either. There was no one to vouch for him, but he may well have been home Friday and Saturday, or he might not have been. Records show that his cell phone was at home. That doesn't necessarily mean he was. "What did you do then?" Webb asks. "Like I told you before, I watched some TV, went to bed early. I'm usually zonked by the end of the week."
"Alone?"
"Yes, alone."
"What about Saturday?"
"I slept in late, hung around the house, caught up on some work, cleaned up a bit."
"Nobody can account for you?"
"No, I guess not."
"What about in the evening?"
He shifts in his chair, folds his arms across his chest, and looks Webb right in the eye. "Look, I wasn't completely honest with you before. In the evening, I had a woman friend in. She spent most of the night." Webb allows a long pause before he says,
"Who was that?"
"My next-door neighbor, Becky Harris. I believe you spoke to her yesterday. I saw you on her doorstep."
"We have spoken to her."
"I don't know what she's told you. I didn't tell you before because I was trying to protect her. She obviously doesn't want anyone knowing about it. She's married. It was a harmless fling. I'm not proud of it. I shouldn't have cheated on my wife, but I was lonely and she was there, so..." He shrugs. "It didn't happen again." Webb studies him through narrowed eyes.
"But it happened before, didn't it?"
Pierce looks at him in surprise.
"So she told you.
You already know all about it." He adds,
"Yeah, we slept together one other time in August. No biggie, just letting off steam for both of us."
"So why did you lie to us, Robert?"
Moen asks. "You told us you never cheated on your wife."
"Why do you think?"
"It makes me look like a bad husband, and that's what you want, isn't it? And maybe I was. But it doesn't mean I killed my wife."
He leans forward and says, "I want you to stop dicking around with me and find out who killed Amanda. I want you to find the bastard who did this."
Webb says,
"Oh, we will."
Moen says, "And Sunday?"
Pierce settles back into his chair again. Sunday I went golfing with some friends all day. I had no idea Amanda wouldn't be coming back that night. All their names and phone numbers must be in the file. They'll confirm it. We had dinner at the clubhouse, and then I went home to wait for Amanda. Any idea who those fingerprints in your house belong to? I imagine some of them are Becky's. What about the other set? He shrugs. No idea. Have you been withholding anything else from us, Pierce? He looks back at Webb, his eyes insolent. Like what? Your wife. Was she having an affair? Pierce chews his lip. I don't know. Really? Webb says conversationally. Maybe she was having an affair and you found out about it. Maybe you knew it wasn't her friend Caroline who she was going away with that weekend. Maybe you knew and you killed her. Robert doesn't even blink. Or maybe you just made that up, that she said she was going away with Caroline. Maybe you arranged to meet your wife somewhere, and she had no idea what you had planned for her. No, Robert says, shaking his head. You're way off base. I didn't think Amanda was having an affair then. The idea never even crossed my mind until I spoke to Caroline that Sunday and realized that Amanda had lied to me. Webb doesn't believe him. Did you know your wife was pregnant? Yes, she planned to terminate it. We didn't want children. Pierce looks at them as if expecting them to have a problem with that. Are we done here? He says. Pierce is rattled, but doing a good job of trying not to show it, Webb thinks. Yes, don't let us keep you, he says, and watches as Pierce pushes the chair back loudly and walks out. He hasn't got a solid alibi, Moen says, once Robert Pierce has left. He could have gone anywhere that Friday and Saturday, left his cell phone at home so it wouldn't give him away. Webb says, the more I see him, the more I don't like him. Smug bastard. He doesn't seem to be particularly sad about his wife, Moen observes. No, Webb agrees. If Amanda was having an affair, then who was she having an affair with? If we knew that, we'd be getting somewhere, Moen mutters. Chapter 13. Olivia searched through the newspaper and the online news on Wednesday for any new information on the murder of Amanda Pierce. It's odd how wrapped up in it she's become so quickly. But there was nothing new, and little in the way of hard facts. It was all simply a rehash of what had been said already. Investigations are continuing. She'd tried to talk to Paul about it the night before in bed. What do you think happened to her? She asked. I don't know. Paul mumbled, trying to read his book. She must have been having an affair, Olivia said. Why else would she lie to her husband about who she was with? It's none of our business, Olivia, Paul said. I know, she replied, a little surprised at his tone. But aren't you curious? No, I'm not, he said. She didn't believe him, and then she'd broached the subject of taking Raleigh to see someone. She didn't expect him to like the idea, but she was unprepared for his reaction. Paul, she said, I'm worried about Raleigh. I know. I think maybe we should send him to a therapist. Here, he put down his book and glared at her.
A therapist?
Yes.
Why the hell would we do that?
Because maybe it would help him to talk to someone.
Olivia, he does not need a therapist. He needs a good kick in the ass.
She glared back at him, annoyed. Then Paul added,
Don't you think you're overreacting?
No, I don't. This is serious, Paul.
Serious, yes, but he's not mentally ill, Olivia.
You don't have to be mentally ill to see a therapist, she said in exasperation. Why did he have to be so backward about these things?
It's just a phase. We'll deal with it. He doesn't need a therapist.
How do you know? What makes you the expert?
I'm not going to discuss it, Olivia, he'd
said sharply, and turned out his bedside table light and turned on his side away from her to go to sleep. She'd lain in bed beside him, fuming, long after he'd begun to snore. Now, as she drinks an afternoon cup of coffee, she recalls that she'd seen Paul reading the article about Amanda Pierce in the paper last night.
He is curious. Of course he is. He just doesn't want to admit it. Paul always could be a little sanctimonious.
The preliminary forensics on the car and Amanda's belongings reveal frustratingly little. Sorry to disappoint you. Sandra Fisher, a forensic pathologist at the ME's office, says, but we didn't get much. Webb nods. He hadn't expected much, with the car having been in the water, but you always hope. She says, we didn't find any blood, skin, or hair except for the victims. Nothing to get a DNA profile from, and we haven't been able to get anything else. No prints, no fibers. Anything from the purse or luggage? Webb asks. They've already looked into her cell phone records, and they haven't revealed anything. Certainly no sign of any man on the side. She shakes her head. Sorry. Webb nods and glances at Moen. Whoever killed Amanda and pushed the car into the lake didn't leave any trace behind. Fisher says, as you know, there was nothing where the car was found to indicate that that was where she was killed. There would have been a lot of blood. Most likely she was murdered somewhere else, and the killer drove her car to that spot to sink it. Webb says, he probably knew the area, knew that would be a good spot to get rid of a car. Deserted, no guardrail, a decent slope, and the water gets deep quickly. Moen nods in agreement. He took a risk that someone might see him, no matter how deserted the road, she says. Find anything else in the car? Anything in the glove box? Webb asks. The owner's manual and the service record. A first aid kit, a tissue packet. She was very tidy. Fisher snorts in apparent disbelief. You should see the shit in my car. Webb swallows his disappointment. He'd been hoping for something. The fingerprints in the Pierce bedroom are a match for Becky Harris, Fisher says. But we don't know who the other set belongs to, not coming up anywhere. Whoever it was in the office and all through the desk, too. Robert Pierce has taken the week off work. It's only Wednesday. They've told him to take whatever time he needs. He has no interest in returning to the office. He wonders if his fellow attorneys in the small five-lawyer firm think he's a murderer. They probably do. He wanders around his house and thinks about his interview with the detectives earlier that afternoon, replaying it over and over again in his mind. He wonders what Becky is doing. He knows she's home. Her car is in the driveway. He's been avoiding her. He used her, rather shamelessly. It doesn't bother him that much. She was awfully easy to seduce. But he's worried about what else she might tell the detectives now that the cat's out of the bag. She told them that they'd slept together. Did she also tell them that he thought Amanda was having an affair? Will she? He would like to know. He finds himself in the kitchen, looking out the sliding glass doors to the patio. It's a mild afternoon, with a tang of fall in the air. He decides to grab a beer and go outside for a bit. Maybe she'll come out, maybe she won't. Robert saunters toward the back of the yard. If she's watching from inside the house, she will be able to see him there. She can't see him on the patio unless she's outside in her own backyard. He hears the unmistakable sound behind him of the door sliding open next door and stops. He knows that no one from the street can see them here. They have all the privacy they need. He turns around and lifts his eyes over the fence at Becky's house. She's standing there in the doorway, staring at him. He walks slowly back along the fence toward her. She looks awful. Her usually silky blonde hair is lank, and she's not wearing any makeup. He wonders how he ever could have slept with her. She looks as if she's aged over the last couple of weeks. She stays in the open door, watching him, her posture rigid. He can't read her expression. Perhaps he has misread her all along. For a moment, he feels a stab of annoyance at her. He smiles. And then she gives a tentative smile back. Her face dimples, and he remembers why he briefly found her attractive. Becky, he says, in that way he knows she likes. Masculine but purring, seductive. She steps slowly out of the door and toward him as if he is drawing her to him with an invisible string.
It's ridiculously easy with her. It always was. He quirks his mouth up on one side, tilts his head at her. Come here, he says, and she does. She comes right up to him at the fence, the way she used to. Becky, he says when she's close. There's not 12 inches separating their faces. I've missed you. She closes her eyes, as if she doesn't want to look at him. Why? Does she think he's a killer? He sees a tear start to form at the corner of one of her eyes. Are you okay? He asks softly. Her eyes flutter open and she shakes her head.
No,
she says, her voice sounding choked. He waits.
They think you killed Amanda?
She says, her voice a whisper. He knows that. He wants to know what she thinks.
I know. But I didn't kill her, Becky. You know that, don't you?
Of course. I know you didn't kill her.
She's more animated now, almost angry on his behalf. You wouldn't be capable of it. I told them that. She frowns.
I don't think they believed me, though.
Oh, well, you know, they're cops, he says. They always think the husband did it.
They know about us,
she says. The way she says us makes him want to cringe, but he's careful not to show it. I know.
I'm sorry, I had to tell them.
It's okay, I told them to. It's okay, Becky.
I wouldn't have said anything, but they knew already.
What?
Someone saw me coming out of your house in the middle of the night, the weekend Amanda disappeared.
Who? His attention is focused more sharply on her now. Who was watching his house in the middle of the night? He'd simply assumed Becky had blurted out the fact that they'd slept together to the police.
I don't know. The detectives wouldn't tell me.
She looks at him, her face blotchy with recent tears and lined by anxiety.
I'm afraid it will get out,
she says, her voice trembling.
I think my fingerprints are in your bedroom. They took my prints at the police station. I don't know what to tell my husband.
She looks at him imploringly, as if he can solve this problem for her. He can't help her. He's barely paying attention to her. He's wondering who saw her leaving his place late at night.
What if the police talk to him?
She looks at him with big, wet eyes. That's your problem, he thinks. Becky, what did you tell the detectives exactly?
Just that we had drinks sometimes, that we talked over the fence, that we slept together the one time in August when Amanda was away, and again that Saturday night, the weekend she disappeared, and that there was no way you could have hurt her.
He nods reassuringly. Did you tell them that I suspected that Amanda was having an affair?
No, of course not. I'm not stupid.
Good. Don't tell them that, because it's not true. I don't know why I said that. She seems taken aback.
Oh.
He wants to make sure she understands. I never thought Amanda was seeing someone else, not until the Sunday night when I talked to Caroline. You've got that, right? You'll remember that? She might even be a little frightened of him now. Good.
Sure,
she says. He nods, doesn't give her the quirky smile. Take care of yourself, Becky. Chapter 14. Olivia is working in the upstairs office that afternoon when she hears the doorbell ring. She wonders if it's the detectives broadening their inquiries. She hastens down the stairs to the front door, but it isn't the two detectives standing there. It's a woman she's never seen before. She's older, maybe close to 60, with a plump figure. Her wide face is lined, her blonde hair is tidy, and she's wearing a pale lipstick. Olivia is about to politely say, no thank you, and shut the door, annoyed about the intrusion, when the woman says, I'm not trying to sell anything, and smiles warmly. Olivia hesitates. My name is Carmen, the woman says in a friendly tone. The name sounds familiar, but Olivia can't place it.
Yes?
I'm sorry to bother you, but I just moved in and my house was broken into recently. I'm going around the neighborhood telling people to keep their eyes open.
Olivia's heart instantly begins to pound. "That's awful," she says, attempting a suitably sympathetic expression. "Did they take much?"
"No, he didn't take anything."
"Oh, that's good," Olivia says. "No harm done, then?" She wants to slam the door in the woman's face, but she doesn't dare be rude to her.
"I wouldn't say no harm done," the woman answers. "The kid snooped through my house. And not just mine. Apparently he broke into other houses as well and hacked into people's computers."
"Oh my," Olivia says, taken aback by the woman's abruptness. "Have they caught who did it?" She hopes her face and voice are what this woman would expect in the circumstances. She's so distressed that she can't tell.
"No, but I got an anonymous letter about it. Apparently it was a teenage boy, and his mother wrote this letter of apology. But I don't know who she is."
She holds up the letter that Olivia wrote and printed and stuck through this woman's mail slot. Has she figured it out? Does she know it was Raleigh? Is that why she's really here, to confront her? Olivia doesn't know how to react, what to say. This woman wouldn't even be here if Olivia hadn't written that letter. The woman looks at her, studying her carefully.
"Are you all right?"
she asks. "Yes, I'm fine," Olivia says, flushing. "I'm sorry I've been ill recently," she lies, "and I'm still not completely well."
"Oh, then I'm sorry to bother you with this," the woman says, looking at her closely.
"I was resting when you rang the doorbell."
"Sorry,"
the woman says sympathetically, but she doesn't go away. Instead, she says,
"I see you've got a basketball hoop in your driveway."
Olivia is rattled and just wants this nosy woman to go away. She really does feel ill and flushed, as if she might faint, but she doesn't want it to seem as if this conversation is upsetting her. In her confusion, she wonders why the woman is mentioning the basketball hoop. And then she realizes.
"Yes?"
It's all she can think of to say.
"Teenagers?"
she asks. Olivia looks back at her now, her eyes meeting the other woman's, and it's like there is an unspoken communication between them. The woman is asking her if it was her son who broke into her house and whether she is the one who wrote the letter. The bloody awful nerve of this woman standing on her doorstep.
"Yes, there are lots of teenagers around here."
"Teenagers can be so difficult," the woman says.
"Do you have children?"
Olivia asks. The woman nods.
"Three. All grown up now and moved away. One of them was a real handful."
Olivia hesitates, on the brink of inviting the woman inside, but then she remembers Paul, and the lawyer, and most of all, Raleigh. She can't admit anything to this woman. Olivia must hold her ground.
"I have one, a boy," Olivia says, rallying. "I've been very lucky. I've never had any problems with him," she lies.
"At least not so far. I'm very proud of him."
"You're very fortunate," the woman says a little coldly.
This woman must know, or suspect by now, that it's her son who broke into her house, and that she's the mortified woman who wrote the letter. Olivia feels sick to her stomach and wants urgently to be done with this conversation.
"Yes, I know," Olivia says. "I really must go. Goodbye."
She closes the door and hurries upstairs, where she runs to the bathroom and throws up her lunch into the toilet bowl. Tears come to her eyes, as they always do when she throws up. But as she remains hovering over the bowl, the tears come in earnest. She has really messed things up. She feels fear and anger in equal measure. This woman is on to her. She has to be. What will happen to Raleigh now? That woman can't prove anything, can she? But Olivia doesn't want Paul or Raleigh, especially not Paul, knowing that she sent those letters. So she can't tell them about that woman's visit to their house, obviously, either. Olivia slowly gets to her feet and rinses her mouth out at the sink. She looks at herself in the mirror. She looks terrible. Unable to deal with this on her own, she calls Glenda and asks her to come over. Glenda arrives about 15 minutes later, her short auburn hair wind-blown and her face lined with concern.
"What's the matter?"
she asks as she steps inside. Olivia knows what she looks like. She looks like she just threw up. She looks distraught.
But if there's anyone she can trust with this, it's Glenda. She can tell Glenda, but not her own husband. What does that say about her marriage? Olivia thinks fleetingly. But there's nothing really wrong with her marriage, she tells herself. This is a special circumstance. She normally doesn't keep anything from Paul, and he doesn't keep anything from her. It's just this one thing that she now wishes she had never done. But she also doesn't want Paul to find out. She wonders if she should simply tell him or not. That's what Glenda's for, emotional support, and to advise her on what to do next. Glenda, she begins, something terrible has happened. Glenda's face falls as if she thinks someone has died. What is it? Olivia leads her into the kitchen and then turns and faces her. I did such a stupid thing with those letters, she says. Oh, Glenda says in obvious relief. I thought there'd been an accident or something. No, Olivia says. Don't worry so much about the letters, Glenda says. It'll blow over. Nobody's going to find out it was Raleigh. I think someone already has. They sit down and Olivia tells her about Carmen. She must be the one who lives next door to Zoe, Olivia says. Remember Zoe talking about it at book club? Glenda bites her lip, thinking. She didn't actually accuse you of writing the letter, did she? Glenda asks. Not in so many words, Olivia admits, but I could tell what she was thinking from the way she was looking at me. She looks at Glenda in misery. I wish I could hide my feelings better, but you know what I'm like. She could tell I was upset, and why would I be unless it was my son who broke into her house? She props her elbows on the kitchen table and holds her head in her hands. She thinks about how it all started just a few days ago, her and Paul grilling Raleigh about it in this very kitchen. If I hadn't written those damn letters, she would never even have known he was there. Paul is going to be furious at me. It's not really your fault, Glenda says, trying to soothe her. You didn't do anything wrong. Raleigh's the one who broke in. You acted out of a sense of decency. You were trying to do the right thing. And it blew up in my face. Olivia replies bitterly. Paul will understand. No, he won't, and Raleigh won't either. But you put those letters through the slots on Sunday night. You didn't see the lawyer till Monday. It's not as if you sent the letters after the lawyer said not to.
No, but I knew Paul didn't like the idea, and I probably should have confessed to it right then in the lawyer's office. But I didn't. At least this would all be out in the open, and I could go back to the lawyer and ask him what to do.
You can still ask the lawyer what to do, but you'll have to come clean with Paul first. You'll have to tell him.
I know, Olivia says miserably. What a mess. And I'm so worried about Raleigh. Why did he do it? Why would he want to snoop around other people's houses?
Glenda shakes her head helplessly. I don't know.
I suggested to Paul last night that maybe we should send Raleigh to a therapist. He told me I was overreacting, that it was just a phase. He's not in favor of it. In fact, he was quite adamant about it. It was the first real argument they'd had in years. The second one will be tonight when she tells him about the letters.
That's the worst thing about being a parent, Glenda says, not knowing if you're doing the right thing, whether you should step in or step back. Our parents just ignored us. Maybe that was better.
I know, Olivia sighs.
Glenda gives her an uneasy glance and then looks away. I worry about Adam all the time, ever since he started drinking. It's not like Keith and I are problem drinkers.
It's the kids he hangs out with, Olivia ventures.
He didn't used to hang out with those kids. He used to be more sporty and academic. Now his grades are slipping and he's missing practice. And he's become so moody and insolent. Frankly, he's awful to be around.
Olivia can hear the strain in Glenda's voice. They all sound strained these days when they're talking about their kids. It didn't used to be this way. They used to sit around the wading pool, chatting and laughing, serene in the expectations that their kids would be bright and beautiful and untroubled. Parents always seem to have overly optimistic visions of their kids' talents and futures when they're toddlers, Olivia thinks. Maybe that's how they manage to keep going. Finally, Glenda gets up to leave.
Not the way we thought it would be, is it?
Glenda walks home thoughtfully. Everyone warns you that the teen years will be tough, but she wasn't expecting anything like what she's dealing with. She thinks about her own problems, her son, what will become of him. She finds herself brushing away sudden tears. What will become of all of them? She thinks back to the night before. A year ago, Adam would have been out at some kind of sports practice or game. She and Keith might have lingered over supper, had another glass of wine, and talked. That's something they don't do anymore. She doesn't buy wine very often at all anymore, because she doesn't want Adam to see them drinking. Is that why she stopped buying it? Or was she afraid that Adam might sneak some of it himself? Probably both. She and Keith don't talk much anymore. At home, things are strained. Oddly, she and Keith only seem like themselves when they're out of the house with other people. She thinks back to the previous Friday night, when she and Keith had gone to the Sharps for dinner. Maybe they'd overdone the drinking a bit themselves that night, letting themselves off the leash because Adam wasn't there to see them, and they'd only had to walk to the next street to get home. Olivia and Paul had been in good spirits. They hadn't known then that their son was out breaking into houses. Olivia had made an excellent roast, and Glenda had drunk her wine and watched her still very handsome husband laughing with Paul, the two of them remembering some of the funny things that had happened over the years. It had been a great evening, like old times. If only they could turn back the clock.
Chapter 15.
Olivia waits until supper is cleaned up and Raleigh is in his room, plugged into his laptop with his headphones on, ostensibly doing homework. Paul is in the living room, glancing through the newspaper. She stands quietly for a moment, watching him. She has to tell him. She sits down near him on the sofa. Paul looks up from the paper.
"We need to talk," Olivia says quietly.
Instantly, a look of concern crosses his face. She doesn't usually start with this kind of opening. It sounds ominous. It is ominous. "What's wrong?" he asks, also with a lowered voice.
"There's something I have to tell you, and you're not going to like it."
Now he looks alarmed. He waits, his eyes focused on her, alert. She says,
"I don't want Raleigh to hear this until we decide what we're going to tell him."
"For Christ's sake, Olivia, what is it? You're scaring me." She takes a deep breath and says,
"Last weekend, before we saw the lawyer, I wrote letters of apology to the people that live in the houses Raleigh broke into."
He looks back at her, incredulous. "But you didn't send them," he says emphatically. She chews the inside of her cheek.
"I did. I put identical anonymous letters through their mail slots."
He stares back at her with his mouth open in obvious disbelief. Then he sputters, "What are you talking about?"
"I took Raleigh out in the car when you were out golfing last Sunday and made him show me the two houses he snuck into."
"And you didn't tell me?"
he hisses at her, clearly furious. "No."
"Why not?"
"Because I knew you wouldn't like it."
"Of course I don't like it!" His voice is rising. "I already told you that I thought an apology was a bad idea, and the lawyer agreed with me."
"I know, and I'm sorry. I did it before we saw the lawyer." She's beginning to cry. "I thought it wouldn't do any harm, and I thought some sort of apology should be made. There was nothing in the letter that would lead back to Raleigh."
He looks at her in cold fury. "I don't like that you went behind my back."
"I know," she says, almost as coldly, "and I'm sorry. But why should you get to make all the decisions?
I don't like it when you tell me what I can and cannot do." She feels furious with him suddenly. Why should he get to decide everything? Even though this time he was absolutely right, she's still smarting because he overruled her the night before on the question of having Raleigh see a therapist. She takes a deep breath and exhales.
"I made a mistake. You were right. I shouldn't have done it. I feel awful about going behind your back, and I felt terrible about not telling you. We've never kept secrets from each other before. We've always been honest with each other.
He turns away from her.
Let's just hope this doesn't jump up and bite us in the ass, he says. How could you do this without talking to me? That's not like you.
Because you gave me no choice, Olivia wants to say, but she remains silent. A moment passes, but the tension between them doesn't dissipate.
So why are you telling me this now?
Paul asks testily, turning back to her again.
Because there may be a problem.
What problem? His voice is tense. Olivia steels herself to tell him the next bit.
A woman came here today. Her name is Carmen something. She lives next door to Zoe from book club.
Olivia pauses, but then forces herself to go on.
Raleigh broke into her house. She's been going around the neighborhood, telling people about the break-in and showing them the letter.
You didn't tell her the truth, did you?
Paul glowers at her.
No, of course not.
Well, that's something, Paul snorts. But she may have guessed.
How?
You know what I'm like, Olivia exclaims. I can't hide anything. I got really nervous. She asked me if I was okay. She could tell I was upset. Then she started asking if I had teenagers in the house. I'm worried that she may have figured it out.
There's a long, pained silence. Olivia can't even look at her husband. She stares miserably at the floor instead.
Jesus, Paul mutters. I can't believe this.
After a moment, he asks,
What was she like?
What do you mean?
Is she the type to pursue this and press charges? Is she likely to come after him?
I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, why was she going around knocking on doors in the first place?
Olivia hears a sound and looks up. Paul looks up, too. She sees Raleigh standing in the living room doorway, looking tense.
Figured what out? Raleigh asks. What's going on?
He looks anxiously at both of them. She glances at Paul. They have to tell him. Raleigh asks,
Why are you crying, Mom? What's happened?
Olivia looks at her husband, gauging the situation. He's already angry at her. They have no choice. She turns back to Raleigh. She hates the thought of Raleigh hearing about the letters, that he might be found out. He'll blame her. He won't take responsibility for his part in it. He'll just blame her for the letters. She pulls herself together. This is what happens when you interfere, she thinks bleakly. Raleigh slouches into an armchair, facing them on the sofa, his expression alarmed.
Am I going to be arrested?
No, Olivia says.
We hope not,
Paul clarifies, and Olivia sees the quick flash of fear in Raleigh's eyes.
I didn't take anything,
Raleigh says quickly.
I'm never going to do it again, I swear.
That's what we hoped, Paul says. But your mother here, against my express wishes, slipped apology letters through the mail slots of the houses you broke into.
Raleigh turns to her in disbelief and obvious fear.
Why would you do that? The lawyer said— I know what the lawyer said, Olivia breaks in. I did it before we saw the lawyer. I thought someone should apologize to these people and let them know that their computers had been hacked. I still think it was the morally right thing to do.
Her voice has become defensive.
And the letters were anonymous. There was nothing in them that could lead to you, Raleigh.
Except that one of the people whose house you broke into came knocking on our front door today,
Paul says,
and your mother got nervous and may have made the woman suspicious.
Raleigh looks like he's about to be sick.
So it's not necessarily over yet, Paul says.
Olivia forces herself to say it. The other house that Raleigh broke into was the Pierces. Paul looks back and forth between the two of them, his face showing disbelief.
And you're just telling me this now?
I didn't think it mattered, Olivia says lamely.
You didn't think— Jesus Christ! The police have been all over that house!
I know, Olivia says.
I don't suppose you wore gloves, Raleigh,
Paul says, turning to his son. Raleigh shakes his head, looking frightened, and says,
I'm not a criminal.
Oh, Christ, Paul says.
The police don't have Raleigh's prints on file, Olivia says, her voice tense. They can't connect Raleigh to the break-ins. Surely they can't prove anything against Raleigh.
What if this woman goes to the police and accuses him? Paul asks. What if they take his prints? They'll know he was in both of those damn houses.
Olivia sends a desperate, pleading look for forgiveness at her son, but he turns and flees upstairs before he bursts into tears again. Raleigh returns to his bedroom and slams the door behind him. He throws himself down on his bed and puts his headphones on and turns his music up loud. He wants to blot the scene downstairs from his mind, but he can't. He keeps thinking about it. How could his mother have been so stupid? He'd wanted to yell at her, but he didn't dare. And his dad? His dad is still furious at him, he can tell. And now his dad is furious at his mom, too. Raleigh's angry at everyone, but he knows deep down that it's mostly his own fault. He lies on his bed, heart pounding, wondering if he's going to be arrested. He will have to see that horrible lawyer again. He feels bad at how much money this might cost his parents. He will make it up to them. He'll be a better son. He'll start doing chores, work harder in school. Raleigh is sick with fear. Every time someone knocks at the door, he's going to think it's the police coming for him. Becky rattles around in her empty house, which is far too big for just one person. It's Wednesday night. Her husband has been away on business all week on the West Coast, although they have been in touch by phone. He'll be home tomorrow evening. She's proud of her husband, Larry, and grateful that he's been successful. She doesn't need to work. But sometimes it's lonely. With the long hours and travel, he missed so much of the kids growing up. She didn't really mind it when the kids were here, but since the twins went off to college, she's missed him. Working from home wasn't her first choice. She'd rather be out of the house. But she wanted to get back into bookkeeping, and the only work she could find was freelance. Now she's made such a mess of things that she wonders if she should just find a full-time job at a shop somewhere, something that will get her out of the house. She needs to keep herself busy, because she'd been thinking far too much about Robert Pierce, alone next door, and what they were like together. She thinks uneasily about him now. He did suspect his wife was having an affair. It makes her uncomfortable what he said to her, telling her what to do. He's lying, and he wants her to lie, too. He's clearly afraid of the police. She can understand that. He doesn't want her telling the detectives that he knew his wife was cheating. Well, she won't tell them. He doesn't have to worry about her. Now she remembers something else. A night in the summer. It was before Becky slept with Robert the first time, but she was already hopelessly attracted to him, devoting far too much of her time to thinking about him. Becky didn't mean to spy on them, but it was a hot night, and she had the upstairs windows open, and she heard music coming from their backyard, some slow jazz piece filtering across the sweet summer air, something romantic. She looked out a window, taking care not to be seen. Robert and Amanda were on the back lawn, wrapped in each other's arms. She felt an immediate stab of jealousy. Oh, to be young and in love again, dancing in the moonlight. Becky couldn't see their faces, but after watching them for a minute, she realized something was wrong. Something about the way they were holding each other. Amanda wasn't relaxing into her husband. She seemed to be moving stiffly as they danced, as if she were unwilling. Almost as if she were being forced. After a moment, Becky saw Amanda's shoulders convulsing. She was sobbing, her face buried in her husband's chest. Now Becky wonders again about what she saw. She'd romanticized Robert, she knows that. What had been going on that night in the dark? Robert couldn't have killed Amanda, Becky tells herself again, staring into the dark. Surely she would know if someone she'd had sex with was a killer. Surely she would be able to tell.
Chapter 16. Carmen is lingering on her front walk on Thursday morning when she sees Zoe come out of the house and head for her car. "Hey, Zoe," she calls and makes her way over to her next-door neighbor's driveway. "Hi, Carmen," Zoe calls. "How are you?"
"Good," she reaches the driveway. "Have you heard anything more about that woman who was killed?"
Zoe shakes her head. "It's too awful. To have somebody murdered who lived so close?" Her expression is solemn. She adds, I'm sure the police will find out who did it. She pauses with her hand on the door of the car. Any luck finding out who broke into your house?
I think so, Carmen says. Do you know the Sharps on Sparrow? They have a teenage boy, right?
Yes, Raleigh. Zoe frowns and narrows her eyes, catching her meaning. You can't think it's him.
Why not?
Well, why would you? He's Olivia and Paul's boy. He would never do something like that. I know Olivia. She's in my book club.
Carmen remains quiet, watching Zoe.
Why do you think it's him? Zoe asks, finally.
I went by there yesterday afternoon, Carmen says. The way she reacted, I'd swear she knew exactly what I was talking about. She looked very nervous and guilty. I'd bet $100 she wrote that letter.
Zoe bristles.
I don't think so.
She pauses.
We were talking about it at book club, and I didn't notice anything.
Maybe you could talk to her, Carmen suggests.
What do you mean?
Find out if it was her son and if she wrote the letter, Carmen says.
I'm not going to ask her that.
Okay, Carmen says, turning away.
Wait, Zoe calls. What are you going to do?
I don't know yet, Carmen says, and heads back inside.
Webb and Moen stand on Becky Harris's front step and ring the bell. They both feel that she is still holding something back, that she knows more than she's telling. Her car is sitting in the driveway. The day is overcast and threatens rain. Webb rings the bell again, flashing an impatient look at Moen. Finally, the door opens. Becky looks like she hasn't slept much. Her hair is pulled back into a ponytail as if she didn't want to bother with it. She's wearing yoga pants and a shapeless sweater.
What do you want? She asks.
May we come in? Webb asks politely.
What for?
We have a few more questions. She sighs and opens the door reluctantly. Webb wonders about her change of mood. The day before, she had been weepy and terrified of exposure, but today she seems resigned. She's had a long, probably sleepless night to think about it. Perhaps she's realizing that it's inevitable that her indiscretions will come out. She leads them into the living room. She doesn't ask them to sit down or offer them anything. It's clear she doesn't want them here. He can't blame her. She's been sleeping with her neighbor, now the chief suspect in a murder investigation. The two detectives sit down on the sofa. Becky finally slumps down in an armchair angled across from them.
We appreciate that this isn't easy for you.
Webb begins. Becky watches him uneasily, her eyes darting to Moen as if for support, and then back to him. But we think there's more that you can tell us.
I told you everything already, Becky says. I don't know anything about Amanda's murder.
She shifts restlessly in her chair.
I told you I don't think he did it. Someone else must have done it.
It's just that we feel you're keeping something from us, Becky, Webb says. There's something you're not telling us.
She looks back at him with a stony, almost angry expression, but her hands are fidgeting in her lap. He notes that the skin around the cuticles is picked raw.
I spoke to him yesterday afternoon over the fence, she says finally.
He waits patiently. She looks down at her lap.
He was outside in the backyard. I saw him and opened the back door. He called me over.
She seems to think for a moment, as if deciding what to say. Webb already doesn't trust the truth to come out of Becky's mouth, but some edited version of it.
He asked me if I thought he'd killed Amanda. I told him of course not. He told me he didn't kill her, and I said I believed him. I told him that you knew about us, that I was worried about my fingerprints in his bedroom and that my husband would find out, that it might ruin my marriage, destroy my family.
Her eyes are starting to fill up. She puts her hands up to her face, covers her mouth. Webb finds himself staring at her ragged cuticles.
Did he say anything else?
He prods when she hasn't spoken for a while. She shakes her head.
Not that I remember.
She sniffles and then looks up at them.
My husband's coming home tonight. This is all going to come out, isn't it?
Webb says, the truth has a way of coming out. She looks at him bitterly,
Then if it does, I hope all of it does. I hope you find the real killer and leave Robert alone, because I don't think he did it.
She pauses as if she's gathering herself. Something in her face has changed, as if she has come to some kind of decision.
There's something else I have to tell you.
Webb leans forward, elbows on knees, and looks at her intently. What's that?
I know Amanda was seeing someone else.
How do you know that? Webb asks, feeling a prickle of excitement.
I saw them together, and I knew. I didn't want to tell you because I know him, and I know he couldn't have killed Amanda either. I knew you'd just go after him like you've gone after Robert, when she was probably murdered by some nutcase somewhere. Not killed by her husband or the man she was seeing, who may have been unfaithful, but wouldn't hurt a fly.
Becky, who did you see Amanda with?
She sighs heavily, regretfully. It was Paul Sharp. His wife, Olivia, is a friend of mine. They live down the street, she says miserably, at number 18.
Tell us what you saw, Becky, Detective Webb urges.
Becky is sick at what she's about to do, but feels she has no choice. Like the detective says, the truth will come out eventually. She's telling the truth now, no more, no less. I saw Paul and Amanda together one night, a short time before Amanda disappeared. It was raining, and they were sitting in Amanda's car. It was about 9 o'clock at night, and I was leaving the movie theater downtown. They were in a parking lot. There's a bar across from the parking lot. I wondered if they'd been in the bar together.
And?
She thinks back, trying to remember every detail. They were in the front seat. She was in the driver's seat. There was a light in the parking lot shining on them, so I could see them quite clearly. I was so shocked at seeing them together. I stopped in my tracks and stared for a minute, but they were so intent on one another that they didn't notice me.
You're absolutely sure it was them?
I'm certain. Their faces were close together at first. I thought they might kiss. But then, after a minute, they seemed to be arguing.
Go on.
He was saying something to her as if he were angry, and she laughed at him and pulled away, and he grabbed her arm.
So you think they were seeing each other? Webb asks.
She nods. That's what it looked like. They seemed intimate. Why else would they be there together?
She looks down at her lap.
I felt awful for Olivia. She's a good friend of mine. Amanda always struck me as a flirt, but I never would have guessed that Paul would cheat on Olivia.
Can you be more specific about the date?
She closes her eyes for a moment, trying to remember. Finally, she opens them and says, It was a Wednesday. It must have been September 20th.
She watches Moen jot it down. Did you see them together any other time? She shakes her head.
No.
Why didn't you tell us this earlier? Detective Webb asks.
I'm sorry, she says, but I don't think Paul is capable of harming anybody, and Olivia's a friend. I hate to do this to her.
Did you ever mention this to Robert Pierce?
No, absolutely not.
You sure about that? Webb presses.
Yes, I'm sure.
Do you happen to know where Paul Sharp works? Moen asks.
Yes, Fanshawe Pharmaceuticals, the same company as my husband, on Water Street, downtown.
She watches Moen write it down. Is there anything else you're holding back? Webb asks. She hears the sarcasm in his voice. She looks right at him and says,
No, that's it.
We need to talk to Paul Sharp, Webb says to Moen over the hood of the car. She nods. He looks at his watch. Let's go. The drive back to downtown Aylesford doesn't take long, a mere 10 minutes. It's a small city, with newer buildings butting up against old in the downtown center. Fanshawe Pharmaceuticals is in a brick building, not far from the Aylesford Bridge. Webb and Moen enter the building and are told that Paul Sharp's office is on the 5th floor. There, they are greeted by a receptionist, whose perfect eyebrows rise ever so slightly when they show their badges. We'd like to speak with Paul Sharp, Webb says.
I'll get him for you, she says.
Webb spends the time staring sightlessly at the expensively bland decor and thinking about Amanda Pierce. They don't wait long.
A man in a navy suit enters the reception area. He's tall, well-built, with very short salt-and-pepper hair, probably close to 50. He's kept himself fit, and he walks toward them with the ease of someone who stays in shape. He casts his eyes over the two of them. He looks wary, Webb thinks. He opens his badge, introduces himself and Moen, and says, "Is there somewhere we can talk privately?" "Sure, let me find a meeting room." Sharp leans over the large reception desk and speaks to the receptionist.
"You can have conference room 3. It's empty," she tells him in a discreet voice.
"Come with me," Sharp says, and they follow him down a carpeted hallway to a glass-walled meeting room. They step inside. There's a long table and chairs and windows that look onto the river and the bridge. The water is dark and choppy today. It has started to rain now, and it's coming down heavily. Sharp closes the door behind them and turns to face them.
"What can I do for you?"
he asks, gesturing to them to take a seat. Webb says, "We're investigating the murder of Amanda Pierce." Sharp nods, his face a careful blank.
"Yes, I've heard about it, of course. She lived in our street and worked here occasionally. It's a terrible thing."
He shakes his head regretfully, frowning.
"How can I help?" "Did you know Amanda Pierce?"
He shakes his head again slowly.
"No. I mean," he amends quickly, "she tempt here sometimes, but it's a big company. She never worked for me directly. I knew her to see her, but I don't think I ever spoke to her."
"Is that right?" Webb says and waits. Sharp flushes slightly, looks uncertain. Webb says, "Are you sure you never spoke to her?" Sharp looks down at the table, arranges his face as if he's concentrating, trying to remember something. Finally, he says, "I think I did sort of meet her once, now that you mention it. Funny, I'd forgotten it." He looks up at them. "I was out for drinks one night after work with some friends, and I think she might have joined us for a drink, but I didn't speak to her. She wasn't sitting near me, and it was loud, you know."
Webb nods. "When was this?"
Sharp looks down and adopts his concentrating face again. Webb isn't buying it, but he waits to see what Sharp comes up with.
"It wasn't that long before she disappeared. I can't remember when, exactly."
"You can't narrow it down more than that, even though she disappeared sometime shortly afterward?" The other man's eyes flash, a slight hint of temper. "I don't remember the date. It was unremarkable at the time, but it was shortly before I heard she disappeared."
"What bar was it?"
"Rogues on Mill Street. Sometimes we go there for drinks after work, not often."
"Who's we?" Webb asks.
"Well, it depends. It changes week to week. Just people from the office, whoever's up for it, you know."
"Can you remember who was there that night when she joined you for a drink?"
Sharp does the same thing again, looks down, furrows his brow for a moment. He's a poor actor and a poor liar.
"I'm sorry, I'm not exactly sure. But me, Holly Jacobs, Manit Prashad, Brian DeCary, Larry Harris, Mike Riley, that's the best I can do."
Moen is busily writing the names down.
"And why did she join you? Did she know someone?"
He shakes his head again.
"You know, I'm not sure. Probably she was temping here that day and came along."
Webb nods. Then he leans in a little closer to Paul Sharp and fixes him with his eyes.
"You know, I'm having a hard time believing you."
"What?" He looks worried now.
"Why?"
"Why?" Webb says.
"Because we have a witness who saw you talking, intimately, with Amanda. Just the two of you in the front seat of her car downtown at around 9 o'clock at night. Not long before she disappeared. Wednesday, September 20th, to be exact."
Sharp's face drains of color. His facade has begun to crumble. He swallows.
"It's not like that."
"Not like what?"
"I wasn't involved with Amanda, if that's what you're thinking."
He exhales deeply, slumps a little in his chair.
"I didn't want to say anything. Maybe I should have, but..."
He runs his hand over his face, and suddenly the pretense seems to fall away.
"Look, I didn't really know Amanda. I only spoke to her that one time in her car. It was to warn her off. She was having an affair with someone here, someone I work with. I told her to stay away from him. I thought she was trouble. I didn't want to see his life fall apart. Maybe it wasn't my place. I wish now I hadn't done it. I should have minded my own business. He adds, the night we had drinks at the bar, that was the night I spoke to Amanda in her car, but I don't remember the date. Webb sits back in his chair and considers the man in front of him. So you weren't having an affair with Amanda yourself? God, no. Sharp's name hadn't come up on her cell phone records. Do you have a burner phone? Moen asks. No. Where were you the weekend starting Friday afternoon, September 29th, till the following Monday morning? Webb asks. Sharp looks at him appalled. You can't honestly think I had anything to do with Amanda Pierce, with what happened to her, he says, his gray-blue eyes alarmed. Webb says, you were seen arguing with her shortly before she disappeared. We're just eliminating possibilities. If you can tell us where you were that weekend, we're good. Okay, Sharp says, nodding. He appears to think. The only thing that stands out is that on Sunday we had my wife's parents over for brunch. They stayed till mid-afternoon. I helped my wife prepare it and clean up afterward. Other than that, it was just a regular weekend at home, I think. We usually stay in on Friday and Saturday night, watch something on Netflix. I imagine that's what we did. Okay, Webb says. Tell us about this affair Amanda was having. Sharp sighs reluctantly, but begins to talk. There was always talk about Amanda. She was a gorgeous woman. She could be a bit of a flirt. The gossip was that she cheated on her husband, that she sometimes got involved with men at work. That was the story, anyway. Sex in the elevators, that sort of thing. A lot of it was probably bullshit, but she had a bit of a reputation. Ask around. We will, Webb assures him. When she disappeared, I thought she'd left her husband. There was no big hue and cry then, even though her husband apparently reported her missing. I thought maybe she'd run away with another guy. Sharp hesitates and adds, like I said, there was a lot of talk about her. I didn't know if it was true or not, but then I saw it for myself. He pauses. So who is this person you work with who you thought was having an affair with her? Webb asks. Sharp sighs heavily. He wouldn't have hurt her, if that's what you're thinking. A name? Sharp says it reluctantly. Larry Harris. He lives next door to Amanda and Robert Pierce. Webb shoots a glance at Moen, sees her eyes widen. What interesting news, Webb thinks. It never ceases to amaze him what they dig up in the course of a criminal investigation, the secrets people keep, or try to. You'd better tell us exactly what you saw.
Chapter 17. Olivia comes to the door when Paul arrives home. He tosses his keys in the bowl on the side table in the hall and takes off his coat. It's slick with rain. Olivia is always affected by the weather, her mood attuned to its changes. Sunny days make her cheerful. Dark, damp, dreary days like this one always get her down. Last night she and Paul had lain in bed not speaking for the better part of an hour, until Paul had finally started snoring. Olivia got up and went downstairs and paced the carpeted living room for hours, worrying about Raleigh and about Carmen coming after him. She fretted about Paul's reluctance to send Raleigh to a therapist. She thinks Paul is still angry at her. He said he'd forgiven her about the letters and that they needed to move on and deal with whatever happened, but it doesn't feel that way. She notices now that Paul hasn't spoken to her. That good, huh? She says lightly, but he barely looks at her. I'm going to change, he says, finally giving her an absent smile. She sees that his trousers are drenched. Do you want something to warm you up? Scotch would be nice. I'm soaked. She pours her husband a drink and checks on dinner. Paul comes back downstairs to the living room and picks up the newspaper. She brings him his scotch. Anything interesting happened today? She asks. No, Paul says, not looking at her. Nothing out of the ordinary. She hands him his drink, and he takes a sip. After a moment, he turns to her and asks, "Have you heard anything more from that woman?" He means Carmen, she's sure.
"No," Olivia says. She adds fretfully, "I wish this would all just go away."
But she doesn't believe that will happen. Instead, she feels as if Carmen is lying in wait for her. Larry has only been home for an hour. His suitcase is still standing at the bottom of the stairs. Becky has made his favorite meal, lasagna and garlic bread, and pie. They're just finishing up the pie. They'd talked about Amanda's murder on the phone while he was away, and in more detail as they ate. It has clearly shocked him. She's told him nothing about her own involvement in the investigation. She knows she will have to explain, and she dreads it. But he just got home, and she's waiting for the right moment. When the doorbell rings, she jumps up to answer the door. She sees the detectives dripping on her doorstep and looks at them in disbelief. "He just got home," she says.
"I'm afraid this can't wait," Webb says. "May we come in?"
"We're eating dinner," she protests.
"Who is it?"
Larry calls from the kitchen, and he appears behind her, wiping his mouth with a napkin. He comes up beside her.
"Who's this?"
he asks. She knows there's nothing she can do. She says wearily,
"They're the detectives I was telling you about. They're investigating Amanda's murder."
Her husband says, "Come in." Webb brushes past her, followed by Moen.
"Can I take your coats?"
Larry offers. Becky watches her husband as he hangs up the detective's wet coats. Her heart is pounding in her chest, and her mouth feels dry. Larry will never forgive her. Becky turns on a couple of lamps, and they all sit down in the living room. The night outside is dark, and the rain beats against the front window.
"I don't know how much your wife has told you," Detective Webb begins, with a sidelong glance at Becky.
The bastard. "I haven't told him much of anything," Becky says. "I told you he just got home."
Larry flashes her a nervous look. Suddenly, she just wants to get it over with. She can't stand waiting for the axe to fall on her neck.
"Larry, there's